Imagine this scenario for a second. You finally secured tickets to a big Broadway show,
Right.
and you've dropped, let's be honest, probably $300 a seat.
At least.
At least, yeah. So you walk up to 50th Street, and you are expecting that standard Broadway ritual, you know, the drill.
Yeah, the cramped lobby.
Exactly. The cramped lobby, the polite ushers pointing you to the left, squeezing past people's knees to get to your little velvet chair.
Spilling your drink on them.
Yes, all of it. And then you expect to just sit there and stare at a giant velvet curtain for 15 minutes. But then you walk through the doors of the Circle in the Square Theater, and well, it isn't there. It's just gone.
It's a complete disorientation.
Completely. Because instead of a theater, you have stepped into this nightclub. I'm talking tiered cabaret-style seating. There are little lamps on the tables, the air feels smoky, and there is no orchestra pit anywhere.
Nowhere to be found.
The brass section, the trumpets, the saxophones, the drums, they are right there on stage, basically staring you in the face. You realize pretty quickly that you aren't just there to watch a show. You are inside the party.
Which creates this really immediate sense of disruption.
Yeah.
It signals to the audience before a single word is even spoken that we are not here to read a biography on stage. We're here to inhabit a vibe.
A vibe, exactly.
And that immersive quality is your very first clue that the show is trying to do something very different with the genre.
And that disruption, that exact vibe, is the subject of today's deep dive. We were talking about Just in Time.
The Bobby Darin story.
Right, the jukebox musical based on the life of Bobby Darin. Now,
I know.
I know. When I say the phrase jukebox musical, some of you listening might immediately roll your eyes.
It has a reputation.
It does. You're probably thinking of a really flimsy script with some top 30 hits just awkwardly shoehorned in.
Which, to be fair, is a very valid criticism of the genre historically. But the stack of research we have in front of us today suggests this particular show is a massive case study in how you reinvent that format.
And just to orient everyone listening, we should mention today is February 25th, 2026.
Time flies.
It really does. This show's been running on Broadway for almost a year now. It premiered back on April 23rd, 2025.
Right.
So we aren't speculating on whether it's going to be a hit or not. We know it
Oh,
works.
it absolutely works.
The mission for today's deep dive is to figure out why it works, and specifically how a show like this survives the one thing that usually kills these big star-driven vehicles.
Which is the original cast leaving.
Yes, the dreaded cast change.
That is the huge question hanging over Broadway right now. We're standing on the precipice of this massive casting shakeup involving Jonathan Groff, Jeremy Jordan, and in a really interesting twist, Matthew Morrison.
I can't wait to get into that.
It's wild, but before we get to the industry gossip, we really need to unpack the actual hardware of this production. We've got to talk about the venue itself.
Well, let's start there. The Circle and the Square. Now, this is already a fairly unique theater to begin with because it's in the round, right?
Right. It's a very tricky space. You don't have a traditional proscenium arch to hide behind. You can't just drop a painted backdrop and call it a day.
Right.
But for Just in Time, the scenic designer, that's Derek McLean, he didn't just decorate the room. According to the production notes, he essentially gutted the entire concept of rows.
Yeah, I was looking at the seating chart earlier, and it is wild. They built two separate stages and installed this massive cabaret seating plan. But here is the thing I don't get.
What's that?
Doesn't that mean fewer seats overall?
It does. It absolutely does.
And that's a huge financial risk, isn't it?
Oh, it's a terrifying risk. In commercial theater, every single seat is potential revenue. When you rip out standard packed theater seating to put in little tables and walkways and aisles, you are drastically reducing your capacity.
You literally have fewer tickets to sell.
Exactly. You have fewer tickets to make your weekly nut.
So why do it? Why take the hit?
Because it allows them to market the show as an experience.
Ah.
They can charge a serious premium for those cabaret tables because you aren't just watching a play. You are at a destination. It justifies that $300 ticket price by offering an exclusivity that a normal cramped theater row just can't match.
I see. So it's the difference between flying coach and flying private, essentially.
That is a great way to put it.
But looking at the logistics of it, this setup sounds like an absolute nightmare for the sound team.
Oh, totally.
You mentioned the band is physically on stage. You've got brass instruments, which are notoriously loud, sitting right next to actors who are moving 360 degrees around an audience.
Yeah.
How do you stop that from just becoming a giant wall of noise?
That is the million-dollar question, and it is exactly why Peter Helensky won the Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Sound Design for this production.
Makes sense.
It's a brilliant technical feat. Think about it, in a normal theater, the sound comes from speakers at the front and just hits you in the face.
Right.
In this setup, Helensky had to create a soundscape that feels like a chaotic, sweaty, energetic nightclub, but still allows you to hear every single whispered line of dialogue over a drummer who is literally 10 feet away from you.
So it's chaos, but it's engineered chaos.
Precisely engineered chaos. If the sound design fails here, the show is just a loud, messy concert, and the narrative gets completely lost. Hilinski made it a piece of theater.
Wow.
It creates that intimacy where you feel like Bobby Darin is singing to you personally rather than just performing for the cheap seats in the balcony.
Speaking of performing to you, let's talk about how the show actually kicks off. Because if I bought a ticket expecting a traditional biography, you know, the whole Bobby was born in the Bronx in 1936, he was a sickly child routine.
Right, the Wikipedia summary.
Exactly. I'd be very, very confused for the first 10 minutes.
You absolutely would be. And this is where the show really deconstructs the biomusical formula. Most of these shows, they try to trick you into believing the actor is the icon immediately.
Yeah, they put on the wig, they do the voice.
Exactly. They put on the costume and they just hope you buy the illusion. Just in Time does the exact opposite.
The notes here describe the opening scene as being set in present day, so 2025 or 2026, and the lead actor walks out as himself.
Right. So originally, Jonathan Groff walks center stage. He is not wearing a wig yet. He's not doing the Bobby Darin accent. He is simply Jonathan Groff, the Broadway star, acknowledging to the room that he is about to step into the skin of Bobby Darin.
I love that concept. It's like he's making a contract with the audience.
Yes.
He's basically saying, look, we all know this is fake, so let's just agree to play pretend together.
It's a brilliant framing device, and it solves a massive problem with biomusicals, which is that uncanny valley
Oh,
effect.
for sure.
You know that feeling where you spend the first 20 minutes of a show just judging if the actor looks or sounds enough like the famous person?
Oh, yeah, you're sitting there like his nose isn't right, his voice is too high.
Exactly. By starting as himself, the actor effectively disarms all of that. He says, "I am not him, but I'm going to channel him for you tonight." It bridges the gap between the modern star, because let's face it, Jonathan Groff is a huge draw in his own right, and the historical figure.
It effectively creates two protagonists in a way. You've got the spirit of Bobby Darin, and then you have the actor trying to catch that spirit.
Perfectly said.
Now, once they make that jump back in time, we land in the 1950s. And what's really fascinating to me is that this massive Broadway spectacle didn't actually start out as a huge spectacle.
Yeah.
The sources emphasize that the show's DNA is much, much smaller.
Well, much smaller and much earlier, too. This project has actually been germinating since 2018.
Wow.
Yeah. It began as this little concert series called The Bobby Darin Story at the 92nd Street Y over in New York.
Which is a legendary venue, obviously, but it's essentially a lecture hall with a stage. It is definitely not a tiered cabaret nightclub.
No, not at all. It was just five concerts. Jonathan Groff and the director, Alex Timbers, worked on it there, just finding the shape of it. Then they did a benefit concert preview at the Signature Theater down in Arlington, Virginia, back in late 2024.
Okay, so it had a long runway.
A very long runway. The point is, this wasn't some corporate product just slapped together by a studio to cash in on a famous song catalog. It was a genuine passion project that Groff and Timbers nurtured for like 7 years.
And you can really feel that concert origin in the structure, I
Yeah.
think, especially in Act One. I mean, looking at the song list for the first half, it is
It
relentless.
doesn't let up.
Splish Splash, Beyond the Sea, Mack the Knife. It's just massive hit after massive hit.
It's a sugar rush. Act One is designed to be the party, but there is a specific sequence in that first act that I think really elevates it above just being a standard tribute concert. It's the Imitation Medley.
I actually saw this in the show notes and highlighted it because I was a bit confused. It lists characters like Elvis Presley and Waite Riders in the Sky. Is the
Yeah.
lead actor playing all of them at once?
He is.
Really?
Yeah. And the thing is, this isn't just some cheap parlor trick to show off his vocal range. This is actually critical to understanding Bobby Darin as a human being. Darin wasn't just a smooth crooner like Frank Sinatra, who basically knew exactly who he was from day one.
Sinatra was just Sinatra.
Right.
Yeah.
But Darin was a musical chameleon. He was desperate to be everything to everyone. He could do gritty rock and roll, he could do twangy country, he could do the slick Sinatra style swing.
So the medley is actually character development. It's showing us that he's constantly trying on these different masks to see what fits.
Exactly. It shows his frantic need to adapt to whatever the crowd wanted. It's incredibly impressive vocally watching Groff or whoever's in the role just switch voices on a dime. But narratively, it tells us that Bobby Darin didn't actually know who he was. He only knew who the audience wanted him to be.
That is such a great insight. It really sets up the tragedy that comes later in the story. But before we get to the tragedy, we have to talk about the romance.
Yes.
We get the introduction of Connie Francis.
The first great love, originally played by Gracie Lawrence, who is absolutely fantastic in the role.
Yeah, she got a lot of praise.
She did. And their big duet, First Real Love, is really the emotional anchor of that entire first act. It grounds the show, so it's not just about flashy showbiz stuff. It becomes about two kids genuinely trying to make it in the industry.
But then intermission hits. And as the old saying goes in musical theater, act one is the wedding and act two is the divorce.
Or in this specific case, the identity crisis. The tone shifts drastically in act two. We get the introduction of Sandra Dee, originally played by Erica Henningsen.
Right. And the music itself changes too. We open with Dream Lover, which is still a total bop, but then we slide into darker, more complicated stuff like 18 Yellow Roses.
Mm.
And then there is this really fascinating pivot into folk music with If I Were a Carpenter.
And that folk era is often completely forgotten by casual fans.
I definitely didn't know about it.
A lot of people don't, but the show treats it as absolutely vital. In the late 60s, Darin actually ditched the tuxedo. He grew a mustache, started wearing denim, and started writing these earnest protest songs.
Wow.
He was desperately chasing authenticity. He started to feel like the Mack the Knife guy was just a total fraud.
Which kind of mirrors the venue transformation in a way. The show strips away the glitz, just like Darin tried to do.
It does. It really does. And it builds to this finale that loops right back around to that meta-theatrical concept we discussed at the beginning. The final number is quite literally titled The Curtain Falls.
Which is maybe a little bit on the nose, isn't it?
I mean, it is, but it earns it. Because by the end of that song, the actor sheds the character once again. We've watched the life, we've seen the death, and we've felt the legacy.
And then I assume, because it's Broadway and people pay $300, they hit you with the big curtain call medley to send you out dancing.
Oh, of course. You've got to sell the merch on the way out, right?
Got to have the mega mix. But, okay, I want to pivot to the right now, the current state of things. Because while the concept and the music are great, a show like this really lives or dies on the guy standing in the spotlight.
Without a doubt.
We're recording this deep dive in late February 2026. And if you look at the marquee outside the Circle in the Square today, things are changing fast.
It is the nature of the beast. Broadway contracts are grueling, especially for a show this demanding. That original trio, Groff, Lawrence and Henningsen, that was lightning in a bottle. Just perfect casting. But we've already seen the supporting cast start to rotate out.
Right, looking at the timeline here.
Right.
Back in September 2025, Sadie Dickerson took over the role of Sandra Dee.
Mm-hmm.
Then in October, Sarah Hyland, who everyone knows from Modern Family, she stepped in as Connie Francis.
Which brings a totally different energy to the stage. Sarah Hyland has this very specific pop comedy background that completely shifts the dynamic of that role compared to Gracie Lawrence. But the elephant in the room isn't the supporting cast, it's Bobby.
Jonathan Groff, the guy who literally helped build the show from the ground up for 7 years, he is leaving.
It's the end of an era. And for the producers, this is the terrifying moment. Can your hit show survive without its creator star?
Well, they clearly aren't taking any chances. They didn't just hire a talented unknown. They announced that Jeremy Jordan is taking over the role starting in April 2026.
Which is just a massive flex.
Yeah.
Jeremy Jordan is basically Broadway royalty for a certain generation of theatergoers. Newsies, Bonnie and Clyde, smash! He has this soaring, powerful rock tenor voice. He is going to sing this score very differently than Groff did.
How so?
Well, Groff is very cerebral and smooth. His vocals glide. Jordan is a power belter. He brings a much more muscular energy. It's going to completely change the sonic landscape of the show.
But here's the thing that really caught my eye when I was reading the trade papers.
Mm-hmm.
There is a gap in the schedule.
There is.
Groff leaves, but Jordan doesn't actually start until April. Now, usually, wouldn't a production just put the understudy on for a few weeks to save some money?
Usually, yes. That is the standard operating procedure. But they aren't doing that here. They went out and got Matthew Morrison to play Bobby Darin just for that interim period.
That is totally wild to me. Huh. Matthew Morrison is a massive headline name. Glee, Hairspray, Finding Neverland. To bring someone like him in For essentially a limited run of a few weeks, that seems incredibly expensive.
Oh, it's definitely expensive, but it is brilliant marketing.
Really?
Think about it. It turns what would normally be a dead zone in the schedule into a limited event. Now you have theater completists saying, oh, I have to see the Matthew Morrison version before it's gone.
Ah, I see.
It keeps the show right in the press cycle. If they had just used an understudy, the headlines would just be Groff leaves just in time. But now the headlines are Morrison enters. It lets them control the narrative entirely.
It really highlights that this is a star vehicle in the truest sense of the word. You absolutely need a name above the title to justify that massive ticket price.
Absolutely. The show is just incredibly demanding. You need someone who can charm a room, handle the physical comedy, do spot-on impressions, and carry the really heavy emotional weight of the second act. There are maybe 5 guys in New York who can actually do this role at this level, and they are currently cycling through 3 of them.
So we've got the incredible cast, we've got the immersive venue, we have the reinvented music. But how did the industry actually respond to all this? We're almost a year out now, so we can look back at the 2025 award season. Did the critics actually get what they were trying to do?
It's a slightly nuanced picture. If you just look at the sheer number of nominations, the show was a juggernaut. It was everywhere.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Tony list right here. Best leading actor for Jonathan Groff, best featured actress for Gracie Lawrence, best orchestrations, costume design, scenic design, sound design. I mean, they were definitely invited to the party.
They were invited, but they didn't really go home with the big trophies there. Our source material makes a very specific point to list all the nominations, but notice it doesn't say winner of best musical.
Right.
And this is actually a really common theme for jukebox musicals. Tony voters tend to be a little bit snobby when it comes to the best musical category. They strongly prefer original scores. So right. While Just in Time was heavily celebrated for its craft and its performances, it didn't sweep those major writing categories at the Tonys.
But the Drama Desk Awards were a different story, right?
They were. The drama desks tend to be a bit more appreciative of the holistic production value. As we mentioned earlier, Peter Hajlensky won for sound design, and significantly, Andrew Resnick and Michael Thurber won for outstanding orchestrations.
Which makes total sense. Mm-hmm. If you have a massive live big band on stage and you are rearranging these classic 50-year-old hits to sound fresh and theatrical, the orchestrations are doing the heavy lifting.
Exactly. And frankly, for a show like this, winning Best Orchestrations is almost a better stamp of approval than winning Best Book.
Really? Why?
Because it tells the ticket buyer, the music in this room sounds incredible. And ultimately, that is what sells tickets for a Bobby Darin show, the music.
That's fair. Though even if the book, which was written by Warren Light and Isaac Oliver, even if it didn't win, it was still nominated for a Drama Desk. So it's not like the script was just an afterthought.
Far from it. Being nominated for Best Book for a jukebox musical is actually extremely high praise. It means you successfully avoided the cliches. You didn't just print out a Wikipedia page and slap some songs between the paragraphs. You actually created a real, functioning, dramatic arc.
So, pulling this all together, we have a show that physically transformed a Broadway theater, successfully navigated the incredibly tricky waters of a bio-musical script, and is now bringing in heavy hitters like Jeremy Jordan and Matthew Morrison to keep the lights on for year 2. What is the big takeaway here for the listener?
I think Just in Time proves that audiences right now are craving event theater.
Event theater.
Yeah. They don't just want to sit in the dark and watch something passive anymore. They want to be in the club. They want to feel the sweat and hear the brass and have that proximity to the performer.
It's the difference between listening to a record in your living room and actually going to a live concert.
Precisely. And by acknowledging the artifice, by having the actor play himself at the start, the show treats the audience with a lot of respect. It basically says, we know he's dead, we know this is a play, but let's celebrate this music together anyway.
Before we wrap up, I want to ask you for one specific detail. You've seen the show, you studied the score, you know the history. Is there one specific creative choice that really sticks with you? Like a hidden gem that maybe the average listener wouldn't catch on a first watch.
Oh, absolutely. There is one creative choice that I find really haunting, actually. It's regarding the song I Am.
I Am. That's one of his big late career self-reflective tracks, right?
Right. It's a deeply personal song. Now, if you buy the cast album for the show, the full song is on there. You hear Groff sing the lyrics. It's Bobby Darin trying to define himself to the world. But in the actual production, in the staging at the Circle in the Square, it is performed purely as an instrumental.
Wait, really? They cut all the words.
They stripped the lyrics out completely, and I think that is the smartest, most provocative move in the entire show.
Why do you say that?
Because the song I Am is a declarative statement. By removing the lyrics, by taking away the specific definitions of who Bobby Darin claims to be in that moment, the show leaves a silence. It leaves a void on stage.
A void for who?
For the audience and for the actor standing there in the spotlight. It suggests that despite all the fame, despite all the hit records, all the name changes, the genre swaps, the different masks, Bobby Darin never actually found the words to say who he really was. The definition of the man was missing.
Wow. That actually gives me chills. It turns the song into a question. I am, and then just got that dot.
Exactly. It invites you, the audience, to fill in the blank. Who is Bobby Darin? For that matter, who is Jonathan Groff or Matthew Morrison or Jeremy Jordan standing there in that silence? It is this incredibly profound moment of reflection amidst all the upbeat splish splash fun.
That is a fantastic note to end on. The idea that sometimes the most powerful thing you can sing on a Broadway stage is nothing at all.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, if you were in New York, do yourself a favor and get to the Circle in the Square. Whether you catch the very end of the Groff era, the Matthew Morrison interlude, or the start of the Jeremy Jordan reign, it sounds like the band is hot and the room is absolutely jumping. Thanks for helping us unpack all of this today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And to everyone listening, keep your ears open. You never know when the next big transformation is coming. We will catch you on the next Deep Dive.